one of the things that Rethinking Sex sets out to do is propose potentially a new and better ethic for our sexual culture, something better and more substantive than consent. And I actually settled on the idea of willing the good of the other, which is Aristotle by way of St. Thomas Aquinas, and it's actually his definition of love. And it basically means wanting the other person's good as much as you would want your own, really willing their good, and seeking out then what the good means for yourself and that other person in a general sense.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm your host, Helen Roy. In this episode, I brought on Christine Emba, a columnist with the Washington Post, to talk about her recently released book, Rethinking Sex, A Provocation. I wanted to talk to Christine because I think that she is part of an emergent movement of female writers of all sorts, from all sorts of different backgrounds, many of them actually from the left, who are chiming in on the folly of sex positivity and many of the lies, the deceptions, and the real downsides of the hookup culture that has been presented to women of Gen X, late Gen X, millennials especially, and now Gen Z. This culture that has been presented to women of these age groups as ideal. So it was such a pleasure to speak to Christine about her book, and I learned a lot from her and from her way of thinking, and it really was a moment for me of proof that people from different backgrounds are kind of coming together on this point in resounding agreement, and that something different is on the horizon. So it's a hopeful conversation. I thought it was an interesting conversation. And if you do enjoy this episode, I ask that you subscribe, like, share with your friends, and keep following for more. Thanks so much. Christine Emba, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thank you so much for having me.
So listeners, as you would have just heard in my introduction, Christine is the author of the book that is coming out, well, as we record, but Rethinking Sex, A Provocation. And I'm going to conduct this interview like I do all of my interviews. And I think it's actually quite fitting for the book, because so much of what we typically talk about on this podcast is covered both in the content and by the sort of structure of your book. So we should start with you personally and your personal intellectual spiritual journey. How did you get to where you are?
Yeah, I mean, a big question. Always hard to condense into a few lines, but maybe we can start from the beginning. So I grew up in a sort of non-denominational evangelical Protestant home. My parents were both Nigerian immigrants and very faithful. And, you know, I was practicing. I was a Christian, am still a Christian. We'll get to that. And then went to college. Went to Princeton, and it was there that, you know, I feel like most people encounter this in college or sort of in those late teens, early 20s moments of life where if you've been brought up with faith, it's sort of like now you either are going to do it or stop. And that's when you decide. And in college, you know, I had a lot of questions that I don't know that the sort of mainstream evangelicalism I was brought up with answered. But I knew that I was a Christian, and I eventually converted to Catholicism by the end of college, because basically I was attracted to the church's intellectual tradition, and thought it was true and beautiful. So I became Catholic, and politically, and still am today. Politically, I think I've been a little all over the map, you know? I mean, I went to, again, like a pretty standard liberal university, but I worked at first The Economist, and then at The New Criterion, a small and pretty conservative arts and culture magazine. And then from there, ended up at The Washington Post as a columnist. And I tend to write about society and ideas and culture, which is kind of anything, really. But I enjoy sort of picking out, looking at sort of day-to-day culture and trying to figure out what larger trends it exemplifies or simplifies and symbolizes, and whether those are, you know, where we're going as a society. And I think I'm perhaps a little bit, actually, Michelle Goldberg in a piece today called me a heterodox thinker, and kind of hard to pin down. But, you know, I think I'm still fairly socially conservative, but more, I think, almost fiscally or policy liberal, perhaps. I think I'm really interested in questions of the common good. How do we make life better for men and women and families, and how do we promote human flourishing? And I think there's a lot of that, a lot of examples of what that can look like in tradition, you know, going back millennia. But I think our policy proposals, and even policy proposals, sometimes especially from the right, are not actually conducive to that state of life.
Right.
So I find myself in mixed company.
Certainly,
I don't know, did that answer the question?
It did, yeah, of course, yeah. I think it's funny, you know, if you're in honest pursuit of the truth, you will find yourself in mixed company. So, I can certainly appreciate that. So what about the way that you see things, you see the world, or the way that you've experienced things led you to pick up on this? I don't want to say trend, but it does seem to be a bit of a movement, a bit of a reaction against mainstream feminism, which is what this podcast is about, what your book is about, and actually several more forthcoming books from different publishers, different authors, many former feminists. Anyway, back to my question. How did you identify this? What about the world sort of stood out to you and made you start rethinking sex?
So I've been a columnist at The Post and writing at The Post for almost 7 years now, which feels insane to me. But, you know, when the Me Too movement happened in late 2017 and 2018, I wrote a lot about that, about the questions that these cases were bringing up, you know, the Harvey Weinstein, the Matt Lauer, etc. And I found them fascinating because, you know, first of all, just the new interest in the fact that these cases were being brought to light showed that, you know, the problems that we thought that the sexual revolution and feminism might have fixed for us hadn't gone away. They hadn't been fully addressed. And the Me Too movement was trying to bring justice to some of these cases. But also at the same time, it brought to light kind of these gray areas, these sort of sticky, thorny questions that we really hadn't addressed and weren't even talking about. And those were the ones that so many women related to. So, you know, you have Harvey Weinstein, obviously, in the Me Too moment. It's like, okay, we have decided you cannot rape your underlings in a hotel room. Great. But then you have stories like Cat Person, where the problem is not even necessarily consent. There's just like something else, something that's off about the situation. And the fact that so many women immediately were like, oh yeah, that happened to me. I relate to that. This horrible situation seems totally normal to me. This is what life is like now. I was sort of just like, what is going on? And so from there, I was drawn to these kind of less discussed, but still very materially present, this malaise almost in our sexual culture that women and men were finally sharing aloud but didn't really have a solution to in the same way. And I wanted to look at and try and figure out like what was going on in our sexual culture that was allowing this to still happen? You know, what were, or were there truths that we were missing out on? Were there assumptions that we've made that were false? Was there some belief that we'd gotten wrong? And like, we talk about sex positivity all the time. We're talking about feminism all the time. Everybody is wearing their, like, this is what a feminist looks like. Women are the future t-shirts. But,
so silly.
You know, the feminist revolution, the sexual revolution we thought would have taken us to some place, where did we end up? It doesn't quite seem to match up. So I wanted to figure out what the disconnect was, because it was really harming women's lives.
Yeah, I hear that. And that the point that you bring up about the t-shirts, it's so interesting to me that feminism as an ideology has become commodified in this very particular way, while also people have become just so increasingly unhappy as it's asserted itself into the center of the culture. And if, I think many people can't put those two things together, but that really pervasive unhappiness and malaise is, it's there if you just open your eyes, you know? So actually, let's go back just one step, and could you give a brief explanation for the audience of what cat person was, as brief as you can, because that's a really key element here. Yeah,
so Cat Person was a short story published by The New Yorker in, I think, early 2018, and it is one of the, if not the most read piece of short fiction the magazine has ever published. And it's a close third-person account of this young woman, this college student, who goes on a date with an older man, and she finds him kind of gross, but they have sex anyway. And then after they have sex, it's sort of an unpleasant experience. She decides that she doesn't want to see him again. But then runs into him in public, and he sends her some horrible, degrading text messages. And like, that's the story. But it's told from the close first person, from the woman's point of view. And I think one of the things that resonated with people is that it really went through sort of her mental vacillations about the whole thing. Like, I don't want to have sex with him, but I'm already in his house. I guess we should do it. This is sort of empowering for me, but I don't really like it. I don't know how I feel about it. But anyway, I guess this is what it's like now. And a lot of women seem to relate to that. And then there was kind of the nonfiction version, which was the Aziz Ansari debacle, when the comedian went on a date with this woman who told her story to the website babe.net. And she said that he basically pressured her into sexual activity, even though she was giving clear nonverbal, importantly, indications that she didn't really want to do this. And she left in tears and described it as the worst night of her life. But again, it was consensual-ish, so things felt very murky, and yet many women could relate to both of those feelings.
So why do you think the common thread here that stands out to me immediately is the issue of consent, and the fact that all of our sexual politics now boils down to, in reality, it's much more complicated, but is thrust into the question of consent. It's the only way that we can understand things, and, you know, as a result, sexual dysfunction is sort of pushed more and more into ever more complicated contracts of consent, you know, things of this nature. But anyway, why do you think that mere consent has become the only standard? And then as a follow-up, why do you think that it's an insufficient one?
Yeah, great questions. And this is a major theme running through Rethinking Sex. Exactly. Consent is not enough. Consent is a legal formulation, you know, but it's not an ethical consideration. It's a floor. it's a baseline that we have to have, of course. And it's great. I mean, it took us a while to get even there. But we want better for ourselves. We should want better for ourselves than just, I didn't criminally assault someone, right? It should be the ceiling of our concerns. And so I think that having consent be what it feels like as the only way that we talk about whether sex is good or bad, just leaves a lot of things out. You know, it leaves out questions of how is the consent obtained? Like, what is the other person feeling in this encounter? Are the things that we're consenting to even good for us or society? Because we can consent to a lot of things that are bad for us, categorically. It just, consent does not make something good. And I think, you know, it's hard to trace exactly how we got. I think there are a lot of threads that go into why we sort of settled on consent. I mean, one is that we live in a pluralistic society, which is a good thing, and consent, perhaps because it's an extremely low bar, is, you know, a common denominator that everyone can agree on. And we as a society have, you know, moved away from, we really don't like, I think, bringing moral discussions actually into the public sphere. So because mm-hmm. consent is kind of legalistic, a lowest common denominator, it doesn't feel judgy. We hate the idea of being judged ourselves or judging other people's activities past, you know, the lowest denominator. So mm-hmm. once consent is had, you don't have to talk about it anymore. And that, you know, feels nice for some people. I also think that consent was developed in part by, or within the structure of colleges, college campuses that were trying to figure out sort of how to protect their students, yes, but also protect themselves from kind of legal and other action that would happen if a student was sort of assaulted on their grounds. And again, consent is like a really clear sort of dividing line, or so we thought, that is comparatively easy for an administrator to turn to when they have to adjudicate a sexual assault case. Unfortunately, what we're finding, of course, is that, you know, there are tons of these gray areas that consent doesn't cover and doesn't explain. And so we've kept like heaping more and more clarifications and adjectives and definitions onto it. You know, no means no has turned into yes means yes, but that actually means affirmative consent. But affirmative consent isn't enough. It has to be enthusiastic consent. And none of these really have gotten to the bottom of the problem, which suggests that, you know, it's insufficient. It's insufficient to talk about consent without recognizing that there has to be a larger ethic behind it, and an ethic that would also, you know, mean an understanding, a shared, hopefully, understanding of what sex actually is, mm-hmm. what it means to people, what real effects it can have, you know, not just physically, but also socially, mentally, emotionally, and what we want from it, and also how we want to interact with each other, how we treat other people, how do we actually be good. And consent just doesn't give us any of those.
Right. It's extremely limiting and flattening. It's one of the many ways that the heart and soul is sort of definitionally divorced from sex. You know, this, in my view, is sort of like the greatest tragedy of everything, is that taking love out of sex and basically the fact that we don't talk about love in our society as cheesy. It sounds cheesy. It sounds trite for me to even bring that up, but or you know, I don't know. And maybe I am just like overly sentimental, but. But I find that to be really deeply tragic, and I think that I'm right, just because, you know, the people that we know in our age group or whatever, you know, that they want love, and that's what they're looking for when they're going out and pursuing these casual encounters or whatever, and the disappointment that follows you know, sometimes it has to be sort of like relitigated in terms of consent. But what's really happening is that oftentimes is that the disappointment is like, is the lack of love in the experience. It's the delta between expectations and reality, and that delta is just like this total absence of charity. Speaking of which, there's a quote from your book that I want to bring up. Both genders have lost confidence in their ability to be together. They no longer know how to do it correctly, or if it's even possible. So I was wondering if you might be able to sort of elaborate on that point, and maybe, you know, now might be a good time to sort of bring love into the picture and talk about your view of love and sex in terms of love and all of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, since we started there, I guess let's talk about love. So one of the things that Rethinking Sex sets out to do is propose potentially a new and better ethic for our sexual culture, something better and more substantive than consent. And I actually settled on the idea of willing the good of the other, which is Aristotle by way of St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's actually his definition of love. And it basically means wanting the other person's good as much as you would want your own, really willing their good, and seeking out then what the good means for yourself and that other person in a general sense. And these two goods can kind of combine to create a better good between them. And that is, I think, to me, like the true definition of love and what a lot of people are searching for. And it's also, I think, a higher standard and a more substantive standard than, again, the very low bar of, did I get the right kind of permission to have sex with you? Which is not collaborative, I think, and not empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly as you were saying, I think, you know, I interviewed so many women and men for this book. And at the end of almost all of my interviews, you know, after they had told me about some of the terrible sexual experiences they had, or the disappointments, or this delta that you describe, I would be like, so what is your idea of a better sexual culture? And the vast majority of them would say something along those lines. They would say, I think it would, you know, I think care or empathy or listening. And one woman, after telling me about this, like, kind of insane sexual encounter, she had this bad hookup. She was like, you know, can we not love each other for a single day? That's what she wanted. And I think a lot of people want that, exactly as you say. But I also think that one of the issues or assumptions about our sexual culture that have taken us down the wrong road is that people don't really feel like they can say that. There's this expectation that to be a good feminist or to be a good modern person, you have to be really chill. You don't want to care. The highest good is actually being able to have sex without feelings and go on your way. And so I think there's almost a sort of space in the conversation that people circle around. Nobody really wants to admit that, like, oh, I actually really want someone to care about me. I want to be responsible for someone and have someone who feels responsibility towards me. And I think the inability to have honest conversations about what we really want, what we're looking for, and what is good for us contributes to this inability to get together, to know how to relate to each other, which I think is the second part of your question. I think there's like a combination of these different false conversations happening and a lack of norms around like what you can even expect from sex, what you should be doing in relationships, that leaves people kind of lost and confused. Women find themselves in these relationships over and over again where they feel used and exploited, and then, you know, don't trust men, basically. You know, like there is a dating book that came out in, I think, 2019 called How to Date Men When You Hate Men, which, like, not that help, like, not a great orientation, you know? For heterosexual women, at least, like, what do you do then?
Yeah.
And then men, I think, in their terms, have also been hurt by this culture because I think men also want love. Men want relationships and care too. But there is, and I actually think that the phrase toxic masculinity is super overused, but also still valid. For many men, there's a sort of shame around saying, you know, that you want a relationship, that you're not actually just out for sex as you should be as a young man. Mm-hmm. But then also post Me Too, a kind of fear of like, consent. There's so many kinds of consent. Like, I don't want to be Harvey Weinstein or West Elm Caleb. Like, I don't know what to do here. Mm-hmm. So maybe I won't do anything mm-hmm. at all. And then you don't pursue relationships. You don't interact with women because you're like too freaked out about all the things that could go wrong. And in the end, both parties end up alone. And that's incredibly sad, but also becoming more evident. Like, we're at a 30-year low in sexual activity, in partnership, and in marriage. Right. It's not great. It's not looking great out there.
No. I really feel badly for so many of my friends who are in the dating market currently. I don't even know what to say about that other than just, I'm so sorry. It's rough out there.
It is.
But how, so, how do you think that, we were talking a lot about the common good and about love in terms of willing the good of another. But how can we reconcile that with, as we mentioned at the beginning, living in this extremely multicultural sort of society with truly different perceptions of the good, and not just a multicultural society, it's sort of beyond that. It's just the atomized sort of hyper-individualistic society with an essentially libertarian understanding of the good in terms of like individual good, you know. So how, if we were to sort of reiterate love as willing the good of another and introduce this into our sexual marketplace lexicon, whatever, you know, how would we reconcile those two things if the good is not a commonly understood thing?
Yeah, that's a really important question, and it's a really hard one. I don't know that, you know, they can be fully reconciled because people are very different. I mean, that said, I think that there are, and I write this is also kind of a point in the book, in Rethinking Sex, that many people can intuit, even if it's not what the culture tells them, that there are certain things that are, you know, better than others, certain things that are true, certain things that they want from themselves and from life. And many of those are things we have in common. You know, most people eventually like do want love. They do want care. Most people can intuit in some ways that sex is not like high-fiving somebody. It's a specific, meaningful activity, not necessarily in every instance, but like in the broad scheme of human activity, there's something different about sex, you know? You know, most people can intuit that, you know, men and women tend to, in the aggregate, although of course there are individuals who are different and, you know, there are exceptions, view sex in a somewhat different way or might experience it differently. And I think one of the things that's going to be really important and that I actually hope that Rethinking Sex can do is begin to just catalyze a conversation. I think the more that we are honest with ourselves about what we intuit to be true, even if it's not, you know, what like Sex and the City movie number 5 or whatever is telling us, if the truth is out there and we're honest about it, we are more able to pursue that truth. And I think more people who are also attracted to it, even if they weren't able to say that before, have recourse to something that will allow them to pursue it. I think honesty and conversation is, you know, are the first steps. And I think just having, I guess, higher standards. In some ways, this is, you know, people talk about these as individual problems, right? Like, oh, I had this encounter with a guy. It was bad. I need to do a better job of standing up for myself and being a better agent and being a better feminist or something. And unfortunately, I don't, while I think that, you know, the individual is important here, social and structural problems in some ways do, you know, necessitate social and structural change. And, you know, I identify as a feminist. I am a feminist. And as I write in the book, like the original feminist movement also called for these changes, right? Sex positivity did not like mean go out and have sex with all the guys. It meant as a society coming to see women's desires and, you know, women's good as important as men's. And they knew that this would necessitate really a sea change in society, like a broad change. And unfortunately, you know, capitalism and easy pop cultural trends, because, you know, just free sex sells, sort of diverted the movement from what it originally meant. But I think we have to go back and realize that this is not something that we can do alone. Like, there has to be a broad and shared social understanding. And that is, again, a thing we get to through conversation and openness, talking with each other and setting norms and standards that we hold each other to.
Yeah, I don't, I agree with you that I don't think that the change, I mean, change on the individual level is where it has to start, in a sort of like Petersonian sense, you know, clean your room. But I think that some sort of structural change is certainly necessary, beyond that. So one more question on this before we sort of move on to your vision of the future. But what might a structural change look like? Like, let's say in a college setting, how can the existing structures be improved to accommodate for a more righteous view of sexual behavior?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so I think I have like kind of ideal changes that would take a real social shift to imply and less idealistic ones. Here, a college one that's pretty obvious. You know, in the intro to my book, in the first chapter, I talk about how in college I went to this play that every freshman has to go to, like an orientation thing called Sex on a Saturday Night. And it was like our sex talk play. And it basically was just about consent. Like, they act out like people going out on a Saturday night, and it's understood that everybody's going to hook up, and then one of the hookups ends up ending in a sexual assault, and that's bad. And then I went to see it 10 years later at my school again during the Me Too movement, and I was like, oh, maybe they've like changed this. And it had not really changed. The only thing was that there was a lecture about consent at the end and how to get the right kind of consent, and that not getting consent was dangerous. And I was like, okay, that doesn't, it's not really telling me very much. And I think like a structural change there would be not to have sex ed, you know, that says, obviously everyone's having sex, here's how you don't get arrested for it, the end. But actually have a space where we talk about what is sex? What does it mean? What does it mean to be good to the other person? What is a relationship? How do we enter into those? And what are our standards for what that looks like? Actually having, again, broad expectations and broad discussion of meaning, of ethics and sort of the morality around sex, and not just, you know, leaving that up to students to figure out. So I think just more clarity there, like having kind of, this is almost the flip side of purity culture, like either not talking about sex at all or talking about it only as in a legal construct. We need more than that. And I think that would help a lot. I think another structural change that's sort of less likely to be enacted right now, although I do actually see individuals in smaller groups moving away from it, is trying to move away from app culture, from dating app culture, which makes it super easy to sort of turn people into commodities. You know, you're like swiping through them. They're not real people. And thus we're not accountable to each other for them. I think having more and better ways of meeting people through community where you're embedded and have responsibility would be really important. Honestly, I think we need more ways of being interdependent when it comes to sex and relationships so that we can hold each other accountable and hold each other to a higher standard.
Have you ever read any Tom Wolfe?
Yes.
Okay. Have you read I Am Charlotte Simmons?
Yes.
Yes.
What so a stressful book.
So stressful, right?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the one that people make fun of him for because George Bush had it, like, earmarked at one point and was photographed with, like, post-its in the book. Anyway, we'll leave that aside. But
you're probably concerned.
I think that that was one of those, works of journalistic fiction or whatever, that really highlighted for me the absurdity of mixed sex dorms. And that's sort of one of those bigger, probably, you know, more further down the line ambitious changes that I think should happen. But I honestly believe that sex segregated dorms are important because of the sort of veil of it's not even about, you know, maintaining mystery or whatever, even though that's part of it. It's just the recognition that men and women are distinct, I think, is part of the problem, in my opinion, at least. I think we're so tempted by recognizing distinction to place things in terms of like superiority or inferiority, and it's not that. It's just if there were any way to just reintroduce sexual distinction into the conversation too, I think that might be useful potentially. But so speaking of sexual distinction, now I'm going to ask you the question to close that I like to ask all of my guests, which is, this is a podcast about womanhood, about being a woman. And I'm curious about what you would think, or what you think is required of women in the 21st century, specifically, to live virtuously. Like, what about our current conditions? What virtues are required of us to sort of meet the times?
Big question, really important question. I think the thrust of Rethinking Sex, the book, when it comes down to it, is simply being honest, being willing to be honest about who we are, what we want, what we care about, what we believe to be true about sex, about gender, about the conditions of modernity, because being honest and being open and like talking about that instead of sort of hiding behind either, you know, trend pieces or false assumptions that have been given to us by media, that's what actually moves us forward into the lives that are both morally good, ethically good, and also good and fulfilling for us that we want. And I think a real condition of flourishing is being honest about the truth, being open and willing to sort of pursue the truth and go after it, even if, you know, it comes at something of a cost. I think obviously it's better when there are more people pursuing the good for themselves and others, but I think just being honest, being clear about what's real and what's not real, what's meaningful and what's not meaningful, who we are as women and what our hopes and dreams are, I think that's valid and really important. That's the first step on any path.
Right. Know thyself. Christine, it has been a real pleasure speaking with you. I want to open the floor to you just one more time to say anything that you think that we might have missed or something that you want to highlight about your book, you know, just go for it. Any final thoughts?
I always feel like I have to have like a really big statement when I'm asked for final thoughts like this. but, you know, I think that, you know, rethinking sex is subtitled a provocation. And the point of that is not, you know, it's not a provocation in that I'm trying to make people angry or trying to make people upset. I think that I am trying to sort of provoke people into actually debating these questions, not necessarily just taking what's given to us by the culture as normal and then allowing it to, frankly, kind of ruin our lives, or at least our sex lives, but really begin to debate between ourselves as a society what's good and what's not. What should our norms and standards be? And for me, I think this started out as kind of an academic question, like, what is going on with our sexual culture? Like, why is everyone so unhappy? But it turned very much into almost a personal and emotional journey, because in some ways I indicted myself. I had to question my own truth and experiences. And I hope that this book, you know, pushes other people to do that as well. And I'm really excited for you guys to read it. So thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. I hope someday we can talk again, because I want to press you and ask you about your point about feminism and capitalism and the connection there. That is a very interesting conversation. That's much bigger than you know, one podcast.
Yeah. But, I get into it in the book.
Maybe someday.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, Christine. Well, thank you again for coming on, and maybe we'll talk again soon.
Indeed. Bye.